Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody.
We're live.
So crazy.
Yay!
So this is the first episode that we are filming since we launched on July 16th, which is just so crazy.
Which is today when we're filming July 16th, which is crazy. I'm so proud of us.
Proud of us, too. We've been, you know, mulling this over for months and months now. Yeah. And yeah. I'm really proud of us too, that we took this idea that we had, that we were like discussing over like dinner, and turned it into like a real thing. So congrats to us also.
And I hope you guys are enjoying the first few episodes. We're excited to keep sharing and growing together.
Totally agree. So what has surprised you so far about the process of launching the podcast?
Oh my gosh. I think I didn't expect it to be, honestly, like so much work. It's a lot to like,
it's so much work
to navigate. For people who aren't techie, like us, it's hard to figure everything out, but with the help of ChatGPT, she's been our savior. And Dan, my fiance, who's been our audio guy, we've slowly figured it out. We're working out the kinks, but, it's hard work, but it's worth it for sure.
I totally agree. I think I was just such a novice in this. I mean, in social media in general, also in the actual practical aspects of doing something like a podcast that I just thought like, oh yeah, we record it and then you just press submit. And there were so many additional steps that
we didn't anticipate.
Mm-hmm. But it's been such a fun learning experience and so fun to do it together. And I'm really excited that it is, that it's taking off.
Yeah. And just for listeners who don't know, like we are both actively still practicing it in the hospital setting. Yes. So this is not our day job. Like this is just something that she finished surgery this morning and then we're doing this now. So we'd be like texting each other back and forth, trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
Did you post this? Can you post that? Yep. Can you edit this? Can like, while we're like in between cases and
many days where one of us sent like a wall of texts and then the other person replied at like 5 PM. So sorry, just finishing my crazy day.
Exactly.
I'm going to get to all of this now. A lot of like 10 p.m. conversations.
A lot of late night combos. But but it worked out and we're excited to continue. And we know that it's just going to get easier as time goes on, I'm sure. But so thank you guys for everyone who's subscribed, who's listened to our first few episodes, who's followed us on Instagram and everything. If you guys haven't, we're at the.push.podcast. That's where you can DM us if you have any questions, any episode recommendations, all that kind of stuff. We're so excited to continue this journey together. Yep. So
we have had so much fun building this to start off with, and we want to continue having these conversations together and having them with you guys. So every like, every subscribe, every comment, every download.
We love them all.
we love them. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel connected to you, but it also allows us to continue this, right? And stick with us on the journey if you've been with us so far.
Yeah. Today, we're going to be talking about elective self-injectomy. Did I say that properly?
Because
that is a hard word to say.
You did say it correctly this time.
In layman's terms, I mean, we're going to dive right into it, but basically what that means is like tying your tubes. Like that's what people usually say is what tying your tubes is. You will go into the details of what exactly that means, but for people who don't know what a self-injectomy is, it's similar to that. So,
well, that's why I think it's so important that we have this discussion, right? Like, number one, I feel like increasingly people are asking for permanent birth control, right? And having a good, like working understanding of what you're asking for, what the options are, what the pros and cons of that may be, and then also ultimately how to access it, I think are really essential items to a lot of people who may be looking to undergo a procedure like this.
Yeah, and don't even know that it's even an option. And, you know, questions that you can ask your provider before like if you're considering permanent birth control, yeah, things like that, we're gonna touch on in this episode for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Sydney, when we first started chatting about this, you jumped on this right away and said that you have seen so much of this on social media, right? So much discussion about self-injectomy.
Tons. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is unfortunately providers who are not allowing younger women to get an elective self-injectomy because they're too young or they're not an appropriate age to be able to make that decision. Mm-hmm, and I've seen a lot of that. I know Dr. Fran, she does a lot, she touches a lot on this, and she actually has a list of providers that you can actually access who will provide an elective self-injectomy to people who are age 22 if they want, if that's something that they want. And I think it's just important to highlight that it is something that, you know, if someone says no to you, it's kind of taking away that autonomy and that ability to make your own decision for yourself, no matter what your age is. So I think that's why it's talked about a lot online, which is important. It really is. So. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. And obviously I'm less plugged in online than you are, although trying hard to fix that.
You're getting there. But you're getting there.
I'm getting there. Someday you will not have to remind me to share things and post our own podcast material on my personal account.
Yes.
Someday I will get there where it's automatic. But you know where I am hearing a lot of this discussion is with my own patients, because I do perform elective self-injectomies. Mm-hmm. First of all, because it's a really lovely, like low risk, low stress surgery compared to a lot of what I do otherwise.
Yep.
But also I'm just seeing really an uptick in demand. And I find a lot of my patients are saying things like that it took them a long time to find somebody who would do it, or that even it took them a long time for their family doctors to take them seriously and send a referral in to a gynecologist to talk about it.
Yeah.
I even had a patient once who told me that she had come into the office with a different provider, and this person wouldn't consent her for a self-injectomy until her husband was present to make sure that he also agreed with this as their form of birth control. Yeah. Which is just wild, right? And again, as somebody who is, you know, perhaps a little bit like of one of more the younger generations, like it does strike me as like crazy that would even be a thing, but I believe it that it's happening.
Yeah, and that's a common theme on social media as well of people having that same shared experience. So
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So Sydney, I'm glad that you brought up the idea of the different terms, right?
Yes.
Like tying your tubes, self-injectomy, because I think that there are a lot of different terms floating around that we are using interchangeably to refer to the same idea, but really fundamentally are different procedures. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for reference, just as kind of like a baseline, the fallopian tube is what we're talking about addressing, right? Mm-hmm. With all of these different things. And the fallopian tube is like the highway between the ovary and the uterus where egg and sperm meet, fertilization occurs, and then ultimately the pregnancy travels down in order to reach the uterus, implant, and grow a baby. Mm-hmm. If we take away that highway, right, or put a blockade in the middle of it, in theory, egg and sperm should not be able to meet, right?
Yeah.
Thus providing really reliable forms of contraception for preventing pregnancy. But tube ligation or tube tying and self-injectomy are actually two really distinct surgeries.
Okay.
A tube ligation refers to cutting, clipping, or cauterizing the fallopian tube. So basically, again, providing like a roadblock, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the DVP all summer long, right? Yeah. They're just rolling out a big roadblock and you cannot get past it.
Yes, that's a great way to
Little
look
Toronto
at
joke for any of our non-Toronto listeners. Self-injectomy, conversely, is either a complete or partial removal of one of the fallopian tubes. So it's like you rolled in your construction crew and you totally tore up the road, right? Mm-hmm. Again, there's a little bit of a difference too between a complete and a partial self-injectomy. Mm-hmm. A partial self-injectomy, there's a few different techniques like the Pomeroy or the Parkland technique, where basically you take at least 2 centimeters of tube at the mid-isthmic portion, which is sort of where it starts to narrow as it approaches the uterus, and you take that section out versus a complete self-injectomy, where you take out the entire tube from the ends, which are called the fimbria, which kind of live in and around the ovary, all the way down to where it implants into the uterus.
Yeah.
Okay. I think what's important to emphasize is that really what this is meant to be is permanent and non-reversible, right?
Yeah.
There is some discussion about tubal reanastomosis or reversals of tube tying, right?
Yeah.
That can only refer to the interruption techniques or the tubal ligation techniques.
Okay.
A complete salpingectomy is not reversible. So there is no way to conceive spontaneously after a complete salpingectomy.
But you could potentially conceive with like reproductive assistance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You still have ovaries. You still have a uterus. And those are the only two things that are really needed for IVF.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It just would require the assistance of our reproductive infertility or endocrinologists. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So salpingectomy is what we're talking about today, again, which is removal of the entire tube.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done laparoscopically. That's usually our preferred method if this is something that's kind of happening as an isolated event. Mm-hmm. But we can also do it at the same time as a cesarean section.
It's really nice. The only way I've seen it done because I don't work in gynecology, but I've seen it done.
You should come to work in gynecology.
I think I would like it. It would probably be really cool to see it done laparoscopically as well. Yeah. I think I would enjoy it.
Yeah. So laparoscopic surgery refers to minimally invasive surgery where we use tiny instruments, tiny incisions. We inflate the belly with gas so that we can see all of the organs.
Yeah.
And then we're able to remove even very big structures through these tiny holes. And so a salpingectomy, again, taking out both fallopian tubes is a really easy laparoscopic surgery.
Yeah.
But also, again, like it's really nice to talk about what we call opportunistic salpingectomy, which usually refers to taking out the tubes at the time of cesarean section for somebody who is already going to have that procedure done.
They're already having open abdominal surgery, already going to see the uterus and everything.
Exactly.
As well, right?
Exactly. So how do you talk about this on the floor with your patients, Sid? Because you will see people in pre-op when they're coming in for their elective C-sections, right?
It's kind of a tricky one because I find a lot of times patients don't have this conversation with their obstetrician in the office before coming in.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's because of time restraints in your prenatal appointments. Mm-hmm. But I do think this is something that should be talked about prior to the day of your surgery.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is something that does come up on the day of, are you having your tubes tied? Or are you not? Yeah. And then sometimes they'll look at me like I have three heads and be like, what do you mean? Like, I didn't even know that was an option. And I'm like, it is your third C-section and you have just told me this is your last. Do you want us to do your bilateral salpingectomy? Because it's something we can do and the risks aren't tremendously high. I mean, this is something you can talk about a bit later on, but it's a great option and a lot of people don't know it exists. So sometimes I'll have patients be like, oh, that is something I'd be interested in. And then I have to go get the obstetrician to come chat with them about it and go over the actual procedure.
Add it to the consent form.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's not impossible. It can be added on if it's something that you know you want ahead of time, though. I would say bring it up to your provider in one of your prenatal appointments if they haven't done so already.
Yeah.
That's definitely something to chat about. And then we'll put it on your file and you can actually already sign the consent forms before coming in for your pre-op, for your C-section in the morning of your C-section. That being said, it can still be done for an emergency C-section as well. If that does happen, you can, again, this is something that we're not going to be like rushing you to the operating room for a C-section, be like, do you want your tubes tied? It's probably something that you should discuss ahead of time. If an emergency C-section was to occur, is this a procedure that you also want done at the same time?
Yeah, I totally agree. So for patients and for listeners who are pregnant already thinking this is my last baby and I don't want to, you know, have to use any contraception right after this.
Yeah.
Having the conversation beforehand, I think is really essential, right?
Key.
Whether you're planning a C-section or not.
Yes.
Because you're totally right. Like it is suboptimal to be adding things to the consent form, especially things that are so life altering, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
At the day that somebody arrives for their surgery, even if that's like an elective, calm C-section, right? Where everything else was planned.
Yeah.
Always best to have a conversation beforehand in the office about it.
Yeah.
And this is something that the vast majority of providers, I would say, are really comfortable providing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I do think it gets a little bit stickier if the first time we're discussing it is when we are rushing you down the hallway for an emergency yes. C-section.
Yes.
And I will say that providers probably have a lower threshold to suggest an interim salpingectomy. Yes. So waiting a little bit, yep. if this is a decision that we feel is possibly being made in duress, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because of the stress, the strain, the trauma of mm-hmm. having your mode of delivery change really suddenly.
Yeah.
Even if you were thinking about this beforehand, yep. right? If this is the first opportunity we've all kind of had as a group had to chat about it,
yeah.
then that may make it a little bit more difficult to access.
Absolutely.
I think,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So even if this is something like if you're pregnant, anticipating a vaginal delivery, mm-hmm. but you know that this is your last child mm-hmm. and you definitely want to have a salpingectomy at some point,
yep.
worth bringing up with your provider, even if a C-section isn't on your plan, right?
Absolutely.
It isn't in your game plan.
Yeah.
Because if that was the case, and if it was safe for you and baby, given like the circumstances of delivery,
yeah.
it certainly is something that we can offer and that we can provide. But again, yeah. I think you'll find some challenges perhaps in getting your provider on board.
Yeah.
If this is something that we're suddenly discussing yeah. like in the 11th hour at 2 a.m. while we're rushing to the OR for an
exactly. urgency. And you don't want to look back and be like, oh, I regret that because I yeah. wasn't in a good frame of mind at that particular moment. Right. So
exactly.
this is something, like you said, that is permanent and you should give it a lot of thought, I think, at yeah. the right moment before you're going through a traumatic experience, like you said.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are some of the reasons that you're seeing online, Sid, about why people may be choosing to have a salpingectomy as opposed to using some of our more traditional or medical forms of birth control?
Yeah, I think the number one reason I'm seeing, at least online too, is it's a hormone-free method.
Yeah, super fair.
So, you know, oral birth control pill, IUDs, they all have hormones, right? And I think there's a large shift in healthcare right now, or at least online, women's health, that people are wanting to kind of take control of their bodies mm-hmm. and their hormones, and they don't want to add anything in.
Yeah.
So I think that they really like that this is an option that is hormone free and yeah. that they don't need to think about, right? It's kind yeah. of similar, I guess, to the IUD in that sense where you just have it done, but like yeah. then you literally don't need, like even with the IUD, you have to have it replaced every yeah, so yeah, often. Yeah. This one you don't need to. So
well, it's forgettable.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And it's also very effective, mm-hmm. which I think is a real selling point yeah. of salpingectomy for the right patient, right? Mm-hmm. In that it is truly our most effective form of birth control. But there are other benefits to having your fallopian tubes out if that is, you know, the right thing for you. And yeah. one of the ones that I love to talk about with my patients the most, especially people who are coming in just looking for contraception, is reduction of your risk of ovarian cancer. Which, yeah. stay with me. I know that sounds crazy. We've just talked about how the tube is a different structure than the ovary and not really connected.
I honestly yeah. don't understand. I just know yeah. that it does reduce your risk. But I don't know how. So I'm intrigued to know how.
So part of the thought process is that some ovarian cancers happen in the fimbria, so the very ends, the little fingers of the fallopian tubes
those
that
are
communicate
so, I love
with
to
the
hold those
ovary.
In my hand when we take them out.
I'm
such
are
a
really
weirdo.
Funny looking.
They're so fun. I like them.
And the best I understand it, at least on a simple level, is just that the process of ovulation, right, mm-hmm. necessarily involves a lot of inflammation, right, mm-hmm. and initiation of the inflammatory cascade, which yeah. sends immune cells and blood flow to that area, right? Because every month we're experiencing this trauma where basically the surface of the ovary kind of explodes in order to allow an egg to come through.
Yeah.
And that creates this like inflammatory soup that is existing between the fallopian tubes, fimbria, those funny little ends, and the surface of the ovary itself. Mm. And importantly, when we're talking about reduction of risk of ovarian cancer, we're talking about epithelial ovarian cancers.
Okay.
So those that do originate on that surface of the ovary as
and
opposed to deep within it.
How common would you say those types of ovarian cancer are? Are they the most common or?
Well,
do you know?
I think what is important to, for like the layperson to take away, is that they are the ones that we hear about the most.
Okay.
In part because they are that, the form of them that is most common is a high grade serous ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that we hear about online a lot when we see these stories of people who had their ovarian cancer diagnosed in stage 3, mm-hmm. right? The ones that are really, mm-hmm. really hard to catch.
Her hair just fell out.
For those of us who are listening in, my clip is just, we're just having like a claw clip failure.
It's a really cute claw clip, though.
It's a really cute claw clip.
But it's not holding your thick hair.
It's
a good half up, half down today. Option.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was great for half up, half down earlier. Mm-hmm. And now it's failing me a little bit.
It's hot, guys, today. This summer.
Yeah.
We're dying.
We're having
so warm.
Oh my gosh, it is such a warm summer in the city of Toronto right now. I'm sure lots of people.
I mean, in Canada, we should be happy about the heat. But anyways.
This is true. This is nothing like what our friends to the south are experiencing right now, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So the data basically is very supportive of this kind of thing. There have been several studies that have been done that have looked at rates of ovarian cancer for patients who've had their tubes out and patients who have not had their tubes out. So there's a big meta-analysis a few years back. And again, a meta-analysis, for those of us who don't have a background in research, is basically where we combine a lot of similar studies, mm-hmm. pool that data to give us even a larger data set so that we can really begin to suss out what is true and what is not about associations.
Which is amazing and not something that, you know, ChatGPT has access to.
No, unfortunately, although maybe someday.
Yeah.
So this meta-analysis looked at patients who had had salpingectomy versus no salpingectomy over about an 18 to 36 year period. So a long time. The follow-up time for the study was really long. Mm-hmm. And they found that patients who had had a salpingectomy had a 50% lower risk of developing epithelial ovarian cancers than those who had not.
Wow.
Which is incredible, right?
Yeah.
And again, for reference, what we're talking about here is a complete salpingectomy. Mm-hmm. So people who have had the entire fallopian tube removed.
Yeah.
Subsequent studies have looked at groups of nearly 60,000 patients and again have compared opportunistic salpingectomy with those undergoing hysterectomy versus tubal ligation alone. And again, it reduced both the rates of serous and epithelial ovarian cancers as a whole during the follow-up period, as well as lower rates for what we would be expected for both of those cancers during the time frame.
Yeah.
So the data is pretty convincing that removing the fallopian tube does decrease someone's overall risk of ovarian cancer.
To me, I feel like no one knows that.
No, it's really and truly a cancer prevention strategy.
It's so, like every patient I tell, they don't know. And like, I feel like even labor and delivery nurses who I talk to, they're like, well, I wish I did it when I had my C-section 5 years ago.
Yeah,
and because then they would have felt better. They would have felt like at least they had that reduction in risk of developing ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
If you're already in there and it's minimally invasive to add that onto your C-section, and you know it's your final child, why wouldn't you do it?
Totally.
That's at least how my opinion on it, but it's something that I think not a lot of people know. And that's again, why we want to talk about it and why we want to share this information out there.
Absolutely. And that is really increasingly why we are recommending complete salpingectomy more and more for people who are looking to have effective surgical contraception, right? Number one, again, decreases the risk of ovarian cancer. It also decreases the risk of subsequent ectopic pregnancy. So there still is a risk of ectopic pregnancy, even if you have your tubes tied, clipped, or a partial aspect removed. While the risk of pregnancy, obviously, as a whole, is much lower than if you hadn't done anything.
Yes.
If you do get pregnant, the risk that pregnancy is ectopic is far higher because we have had abnormalities and trauma to those tubes.
Yes.
Ectopic pregnancies, for those who aren't familiar with the term, are just any pregnancies that implant somewhere other than that inner aspect of the uterus where they are meant to implant.
Yes.
And the tubes is the most common place where the vast majority of ectopic pregnancies end up implanting.
Yeah, yeah.
The complication rates between tubal ligation or partial salpingectomy and complete salpingectomy are similar. And truly, although we don't really have the data to support this at that time, the efficacy rate for a complete salpingectomy should approach 100%, right?
Yeah.
So it really should be kind of the best,
really the best
surgical method of contraception. So increasingly, you know, our societies, including the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists mm-hmm. of Canada mm-hmm. and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have recommended that we discuss these possible cancer prevention benefits as well as the overall benefits of complete salpingectomy with our patients who are considering permanent forms of contraception.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk about it. Ask the questions. Advocate for yourself. If mm-hmm. this is something that you want done. Yeah. Talk to your providers, okay, guys? Like, sometimes mm-hmm. it's not always brought up, but that's why we're here. We're Perfect. Here to help you.
Totally. Now, Sid, yeah. I understand that you have scanned social media. Mm-hmm. You have gathered some questions that you have seen yeah. repeated over and over
yes.
when we are talking about the concept of surgical or permanent contraception.
Yes.
So let me have them. What are our myths that we need to bust today?
Yes.
You or, need, confirm.
Or confirm. These. That's a good way of putting it. Okay. First one. Isn't it just a hysterectomy?
No. So people, I think, are often very confused about the ectomies of it all, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all in Latin.
They're all big words that don't make sense.
What are we actually talking about taking out? Mm-hmm. So salpingectomy refers to just taking out the fallopian tube, mm-hmm. right? So if we are doing a bilateral salpingectomy, it means we are only taking out the fallopian tube on both sides because we have one on the right and one on the left.
We're leaving the ovaries. We're not touching the uterus.
Ovaries stay inside. Uterus stays inside. Cervix yeah. stays inside.
Yeah.
A hysterectomy refers to removal of the uterus, which yeah. is not part and parcel of this surgery. Although we do lots of hysterectomies for other reasons, yeah. it is not required in order to perform or to provide surgical contraception.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then another one that I've seen a lot of people mm-hmm. get confused about or don't know the answer to mm-hmm. is that having your tubes tied or a mm-hmm. bilateral self-injectomy in this case will mess up your hormones completely. Yeah.
Super common misconception. And I find even for patients that are looking to have a hysterectomy,
yeah.
that they often think that they are going to go into like a chemical menopause,
yeah.
it, right? That they're going to feel different. And the truth is that the tubes in the uterus are really just more hormonally responsive. Mm. They do not produce hormones themselves. So they are not going to be producing the estrogen that keeps you in your reproductive state.
That's all on the ovaries.
All on the ovaries, exactly. So, I mean, simplification. There's lots of, the hormonal system is so complicated and there's lots of ways that estrogen is produced in our body. But suffice to say, taking out your tubes is not going to touch that one way or another.
Okay, that's good to know. That's really good to mm-hmm. know. Okay, next one. I'll go into menopause early if I have a bilateral self-injectomy.
Super reasonable question, right? Like the tubes are close to the ovaries. The blood supply is very close to one another, right? Mm-hmm. And so although we did not think that made sense, I think listeners will be happy to know that we actually have really robust data to support the fact that that's not true. You will not go into menopause any sooner.
Yeah.
There was a Canadian study actually done by our colleagues out in British Columbia in 2020 that was a population-based retrospective study of 41,000 patients. So a lot of women who had undergone self-injectomy under the age of 50 at the time of hysterectomy or self-injectomy alone.
Okay.
And they showed no evidence of earlier onset of menopause than the groups that hadn't.
Okay. And mm-hmm. is there a risk in potentially something going wrong in the surgery leading to menopause happening earlier? Like what if something happens during the surgery? Does that ever happen?
That's a super good question. And I would say that while anything can happen mm-hmm. in any surgery, mm-hmm. right? Or in any treatment of any medical condition, I would say that would be exceedingly rare to the point that I don't think we would even be able to guess the incidence of that.
Okay.
The major blood supply to the ovary comes through the infundibulopelvic ligament, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, is very close to the fallopian tube.
Okay.
And there are certainly cases where patients may have other disorders like endometriosis or previous surgeries that render the scar tissue in the abdomen significant enough that it may be
more
difficult to identify appropriately every structure. Mm-hmm. So it is always a risk that damage to surrounding organs could occur. And certainly in the case of a salpingectomy, that main blood supply to the ovary is nearby. But practically, have I seen it happen? I don't think I've ever seen it happen in the time of a salpingectomy.
Okay.
So I would say that it is exceedingly rare. And truly, you would need to knock off both ovaries
in order to go into menopause. I was just going to say, if you are left, let's say, for example, one needs to be taken out.
Yes.
If you still have an ovary, you're good. Like, yes, you're not going to go into early menopause.
We have lots of young women who've had to have an ovary removed for other reasons.
Yeah.
And they continue to experience normal hormonal status
during
the reproductive years. And so while it's not impossible, right, I would say that certainly would not be a fear that I would want any of my patients to really be harboring going into a self-injectomy, because the risk would be just so extraordinarily rare.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Next one. It's reversible, right?
No, this is permanent. And I think we really need to look at all self-injectomies as permanent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We do have some data regarding like reanastomosis of tubes. And that is a procedure that some people do. I have done a few of them. It's a fun surgery.
Yeah.
But really and truly, we have other good forms of contraception as well. And the best evidence and the best benefit is for a complete self-injectomy.
Yeah.
And so increasingly, that is what we are leaning towards as we are approaching permanent forms of contraception. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that people can't find someone who will do a partial self-injectomy or a tubal ligation, but I think important to know that we lose some of the benefit of things like reduction of risk of ectopic pregnancy.
Yes.
It is not a guarantee that it is reversible. Mm-hmm. And truly, if you're coming to a surgeon for permanent contraception, unfortunately, it is the inferior option, right? It is a less effective form of permanent contraception than removing the tube as a whole, and you lose the benefit of reduction of ovarian cancer risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Last one I have here is, I can't get it unless I'm over 35 or have three kids.
Definitely not a rule. And I have done many self-injectomies on people who have no kids, right? And who are under 35.
Yeah.
I think that it is still a bit of a challenge, I think, to find providers though in some areas. And now again, our bias here is that we live in a major metropolitan center, right? Where it's considerably easier than in other places to see a gynecologist and to find a new one, right?
Yeah.
You're not given the answer that you think is right for you.
Exactly. We can always get a second opinion, a third opinion.
Exactly. But there are areas of our country, never mind the rest of the world, where that is not true, right? And where older ideals surrounding the importance of preservation of fertility, right?
Yeah.
Even for people who have no plans to conceive,
is
maybe valued a little bit more. And so that's not to say that that's okay.
Yeah.
Right? My belief is that if you are competent to make the decision, then that is something that we should support. And there are certainly benefits to having your tubes out, right?
Absolutely.
If you are sure that this is what you want, if you are competent to make this decision, then I'm happy to provide it for you.
Yeah.
And it's a shame from where I sit that may not be what people are experiencing everywhere.
I know. And I've seen that a lot, kind of, as I said, like a lot online where
there's
these younger women who almost feel like they have to prove that it's the right decision for them and their body. And I feel like that's not something that you should ever need to prove to anyone, right?
Yeah.
Like if this is a decision that you have made and you've reviewed the risks and the benefits for yourself, you shouldn't have to fight for it.
Yeah.
We're working towards hopefully one day having it be accessible to everyone in every age and every stage. And the first step in that is just talking about it and spreading awareness. I know there's some great advocates online who have formed pages with contacts of providers who will provide bilateral self-injectomies to women who haven't had children or who are younger. And this is stuff that you can still see online, but hopefully one day it'll be accessible to everyone.
Yeah. And you know what? To be so fair to at least people that like I know who've trained in Canada, for instance, I do think that in the past, a lot of the information that we received, a lot of the studies that were looking at this focused on as well the rates of regret after having your tubes tied.
Yeah.
And that was something that we often looked at and we measured and we really perseverated over. And it's not to say that that isn't an important data point to capture as we're trying to conceptualize the experience of, you know, seeking out permanent contraception and, you know, undergoing these kinds of procedures. But I do think that it's still kind of, although it feels like advocacy, it feels like concern, it circles back to paternalism. If we are trying to make surgical decisions for our patients based on a theoretical risk of regret, even if in past studies that rate of regret has seemed like unacceptably high to us. Mm-hmm. And again, this is data points that are debatable. We're re-examining. We're looking at all of this kind of thing. But I think kind of irrespective of the actual incidents, if someone feels sure that this is what they want, they're competent to make their own medical decision.
Yep.
And adults are allowed to feel regret.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
The fact that they may regret it one day doesn't make it any less paternalistic for me to reject their request.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%.
Like, yeah.
You know, I don't know if this sounds harsh, but you have to live with the decisions you make. And if at the time that decision was really important to you, and then 10 years down the line, you change your mind. It's, we've all done that with certain things in life. And, it is a big decision that is something that shouldn't be taken lightly.
Yeah.
But saying all of that, you still should be able to make that decision for yourself and have it accessible to you if that's something that you feel is right for you and your body.
Absolutely. And I think far better that somebody regret a decision that they made that they felt they were autonomous in making and that they had support from their system and from the healthcare system in approaching. Far better that that occurred than that somebody feel as though they are having their autonomy stripped from them.
Yes.
Right? And are unable to access something that they know is right for their body.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, as we kind of said earlier, there are ways to still carry a pregnancy or at least have a baby. You can do IVF if that is something that you do really want later in life after you've had a bilateral self-injectomy.
Absolutely.
Obviously, as you said too, I still want to highlight it is permanent contraception and it should be looked at that way.
Yes, yeah.
But there are things that can be done.
There are many ways to make a family.
Yeah, exactly.
Really what we're talking about is the rate of spontaneous conception being dramatically decreased.
Yeah.
So there are some risks, though, to this procedure, right? Mm-hmm. It's not quite as laissez-faire as we're making it sound. There's always, this requires anesthesia, right? Mm-hmm. And it requires a general anesthesia, which certainly is not required if I am writing a prescription for the birth control pill, right?
Or
putting in an IUD for the most part.
Or,
what?
Husband gets
a vasectomy.
Vasectomy. I was like, I cannot
just
think of,
over here for those listening in their cars making a snipping motion with her.
I'm
fingers.
So sorry. I cannot think of the word vasectomy there for a minute. But a vasectomy.
Yeah. Kay. Exactly. Right? Like there are risks to general anesthesia and there are risks to surgical procedures, even laparoscopic procedures, which are minimally invasive. When we look at ligation versus self-injectomy as well. Taking out the entire fallopian tube does add a little bit of operating time, right? So it does make for a little bit of a longer procedure. As we kind of alluded to earlier, it may not be technically feasible in all patients, right?
Yep.
So again, somebody for whom the tubes are totally occluded, if there's a lot of other structure surrounding them, if I don't feel I can safely access the entire tube and we're not here to do a bigger surgery like an endometriosis resection, for instance, then something like a partial self-injectomy is really appropriate in that case, right?
I've also had patients who have said they wanted it and then unfortunately have experienced like a postpartum hemorrhage during a C-section and then that doesn't become the priority in instance, right?
So
that's just something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, as well. With respect to tubal interruption with the clips and bands and things like that that were used in the past, we do see a high rate of migration of those things. So they don't tend to stay in the tube where they very frequently will move elsewhere in the pelvis. But I think importantly for anybody who's listening to me say that, who's had a clipping or something in the past and you go, oh God, where is this? Where's my clip now? There is no evidence that it is associated with any adverse events.
Okay, good.
So if you were to go in later for a surgery, which we often sometimes do, right? Yeah. Like 20 years later to remove the uterus for some other indication, we often kind of see the clips hanging out in funny places. But we do not see an increased incidence of any kind of real world, real life issue. For
like no
the
pain
patient.
Or no, anything like
no.
that.
No, when we've looked at the data, we don't really see that is the case. So that is good. Small but real risks, right, are risk of bleeding, right? Risk of infection, because it is a surgery.
With any surgery.
Risk of damage to surrounding organs. And we've talked a little bit about the infundibulopelvic ligament and its proximity to the fallopian tube. Another risk as well that we talk about is conversion to laparotomy, right? So this is a super minimally invasive surgery, but every surgery that I consent someone for that I intend to do laparoscopically, I also let them know that there is a chance that I may need to open for safety purposes and make a larger incision, right? And that is certainly no less true for an elective salpingectomy, although the incidence is really small. Mm-hmm. So there's an old study called the CREST study, the Collaborative Review of Sterilization, that was like a massive landmark study, I think, in the US. It looked at over 10,000 women, and the total laparotomy rate was only 0.9%.
Okay.
Now, this was in 1996.
Oh, okay.
So, laparoscopy was really in its infancy at that time, and I would hazard a guess that the rates are far, far less now for salpingectomy.
Totally.
Exactly. Post-op recovery is usually pretty mild, really well tolerated for laparoscopic surgeries in general. And something that I learned that was interesting, though, in looking at tubal ligation versus salpingectomy was with respect to the post-op pain incidence for those two procedures. You would kind of think that the tubal ligation would be less painful because it's kind of quicker and it's a little bit less invasive in the sense we're not taking something out. But there was a Cochrane review that was published in 2015. And for those listeners who've listened to me like wax on about levels of evidence before, Cochrane reviews are really high level, really trusted, systematic reviews where we pool that data, right, to look at even bigger numbers to really begin to tell with confidence what is related to something and what is not. And they actually found in this review that bands and clips seem to cause more pain than electrosurgery, which is used to remove the tube. Patients are three and a half times more likely to experience post-op pain with a band or a clip, as well as 2.5 times more likely to require oral pain medication post-operatively. And the thought is that the bands and the clips kind of cause that section of the tube to die, right? And become ischemic, and that there is a transient bump in pain.
Okay.
However, I think important to note for anybody considering the former surgery is that when we look at pain post-op at the post-op visit, which usually is around 4 to 6 weeks, the pain levels are equivocal.
Okay.
Right? So it really is just in that like immediate post-op period that
they're usually in hospital and can access pain meds too, right?
Well, this is an outpatient surgery in most places. True. So that's home at that point, but still,
but you usually go home
with a prescription for medication, but certainly something to be aware of if patients are kind of trying to debate between these two procedures as an option for them.
And what I'll throw in there from what I know for my C-section patients is that they don't notice any different. Like I've had lots of C-section patients. You have like you're going to have post-op pain from a C-section. You add in the bilateral salpingectomy and you don't really notice any difference.
I'll admit I don't have a stat to pull for that, but I would hazard a guess that in the context of a C-section, that you're not going to, like, I think we would have a really hard time sussing out whether there was any increase in pain from the salpingectomy component. And we know as well, I know that there in the past has been some concern regarding salpingectomy at time of C-section because the blood vessels are more engorged when you're pregnant. And we really have not found that there is any increased risk of major complications associated with taking out the tubes at
time of section. As opposed to something like a hysterectomy, which is a lot more
complicated at time of C-section.
Exactly. Yeah, like that's not something we ever want to do.
No. We try not to do that on purpose unless it is like very well planned and for very specific reasons. Perfect. Another important thing that I learned, I think, as we're talking about like opportunistic salpingectomy, right, is that we often think of that, like this opportunity to take out the tubes being really limited to C-section, right? And I think that makes sense because it's in the context of family planning and talking about pregnancy. But we go into people's bellies for all sorts of different reasons. Right? There are lots of opportunities to do a salpingectomy.
That's a very good point.
Both for contraception and again, for ovarian cancer prevention. And these epithelial ovarian cancers, these high-grade serouses are really bad when we get them.
So are, what you're telling me is like, if you go in for, I don't know, an appendectomy, they can potentially do it at the same time?
Why not? Right? And unless, I mean, appendectomy may be a specific circumstance because
it's a different
surgeon. In many cases, appendectomies are done at the time of infection, right? Although how much that is or isn't going to impact something, I think is debatable, taking out the tubes at the same time. But there was a 2020 study by Tomash and al. That looked at patients undergoing elective laparoscopic gallbladder removal.
Oh,
so just for gallstones.
which is pretty fairly common too.
Fairly common. Yeah. And they found that when patients were offered a concurrent self-injectomy, 60% of them accepted. Mm. Subsequent studies have shown no additional postoperative complications attributed to the self-injectomy portion of that procedure.
Wow.
So great, general surgery colleagues, call me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Call us. Ask your patients if they bring this up to you. And patients as well, if you are undergoing a laparoscopic abdominal surgery for a different reason, feel free to ask your surgeon.
It's going to reduce your risk of ovarian cancer.
Totally.
Why not add it on?
Listen, it requires some coordination on our end, right? From the perspective of the surgeon, to have a gynecologist who's available to come and do the self-injectomy portion of the procedure.
Yeah.
But again, especially for these simple, quick, laparoscopic elective procedures, to add on a self-injectomy adds very little OR time and potentially has a lot of benefit for you. And I think it's not any patient's responsibility to think of like the systems implications of combining some of these procedures.
Yeah.
And there, if this is something that you're already thinking that you want, that's a great opportunity, right? We have to stop thinking about opportunistic self-injectomy only in the realm of OBGYN.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's so true. And that's something for everyone to start thinking about, right? It's kind of more of that holistic care of like looking at the patient as a whole, right? Yeah, I think a lot of departments get very like laser focused into just what they're doing, and that's totally like reasonable.
Very siloed,
but it's good to look at the patient and what will benefit them in the long run. And if they're already going for surgery, they're already going to be asleep. Why not do it?
Yeah. So said, as we wrap this up, what are some key takeaways that you would like our patients and our listeners to know with respect to elective self-injectomy?
I think the main thing I want everyone to know is that permanent contraception should never be out of reach because someone else doesn't think you're ready. Mm-hmm. So that means advocating for yourself, making sure that you have the questions ahead, like the questions prepared ahead of time for your provider so that you can advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
Because this is something that can benefit a lot of people, and no one should be able to tell you no, because it's something that you think would be great for you and your body. You should be able to access it. So get your third, fourth, fifth opinions if you need to. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you won't need to, but how about you?
I think what I hope that people have taken away from kind of the data behind this is that elective self-injectomy is safe. Elective self-injectomy is effective. And it has benefits that extend beyond contraception, right? Yeah. We really can't understate the benefits in ovarian cancer risk reduction, right? Although the absolute risk of having an ovarian cancer in your lifetime is still low, the relative risk reduction of removing your tubes is really compelling and certainly is something that I think should be talked about more, right?
Which is why we're talking about it. On the Push podcast.
Absolutely. So guys, share your experiences
with
us.
Let us know if you've had it.
Exactly. Have you had a self-injectomy? Have you had your tubes tied? Right?
Yeah.
Have you had do you know which version of the permanent contraception methods we've discussed today that you've had?
Yeah. DM us on Instagram. Talk about it at the.push.podcast if you guys haven't followed us. Tell us. Tell us your stories. We want to hear them.
Until then, we will see you next time.
Bye.